Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to Madison's Notes, the official podcast of Princeton University's James Madison Program in American Ideals and Institutions. I'm your host, Annika Nordquist. Today, we're here to discuss practical lessons on leadership and statesmanship from great thinkers and leaders from history. Here to discuss is Johnny A. Burtko IV, the president and CEO of the Intercollegiate Studies Institute. ISI is a nonprofit organization founded in 1953 by William F. Buckley that introduces students to the American tradition of liberty and to a vibrant community of students and scholars. I myself participated in and really, really benefited from ISI's programming when I myself was an undergraduate, so it's especially fun for me to be able to chat with Johnny today. He has recently released an edited volume, Gateway to Statesmanship, Selections from Xenophon to Churchill, which contains selection from a really wide variety of thinkers all through the ancient, medieval, Renaissance, and modern periods, men and women from a variety of different traditions, all meant to spark discussion about the nature of statesmanship. So, with no further ado, I really hope that you enjoy this discussion. Johnny, welcome to the show. I'm so excited to have you on.
I'm excited to be here.
So to kick us off, you've this book in the introduction, you say it's in the Mirrors for Princes tradition. And I think kind of the first thing as an American that occurs to someone is, wait a minute, there's no one in America who's a prince, not one person. And so kind of given that, I mean, it seems like the idea of what a statesman entails has changed so much over the past 2,000-3,000 years. And you've got this book that spans all of it and then says, for something today, in a country where we don't have princes, the Mirrors for Princes tradition is relevant. So why is that the case? Why do you think that there's kind of this constant thread?
Yeah, that's a great question to start off, Annika. And I would say, you know, I think each of us are princes in our respective domain. But, you know, to unpack that a little bit more, one of my key arguments is that the fundamental ingredients of statesmanship have not changed over time, you know, in part because human nature is fixed. And regardless of the regime type, I think people are generally looking for the same qualities in their political leaders. So part of the reason that I was drawn to the Mirrors for Princes tradition is because in our own contemporary American context, you know, if we look around right now, a lot of people are complaining constantly about the political leadership we have in Washington, D.C., but very few people are actually articulating the qualities that we want to see in political leaders today. And I think it's interesting that America has so many, I mean, dozens upon dozens of self-help books for entrepreneurs, right? Helping them to be, you know, found a unicorn company, but nothing comparable for statesmen. And really, the Mirrors for Princes was a very practical tradition that offered moral, you know, and theoretical and, you know, management advice for political leaders. And it existed in literally every civilization known to mankind. And in our own country doesn't have that tradition. And so this is an attempt to both recover it, but also revive it within the context of our own, you know, constitution and American framework.
Yeah, and I really like that. You use the word embattled at the beginning of your introduction, and it's kind of funny because people are very quick to be like, we have the world's worst politicians, our politicians are terrible, but there's not a lot of discussion of, is it because we're not actually giving them the tools to be good politicians? Is there kind of a step back that you can take beyond the very last where you're like, I would prefer if they didn't embezzle money, I would prefer if they didn't do this and that, but is there something kind of more primal that we can be working on? The practicality, I think what you talk about is very key, but it's also kind of interesting because some of the thinkers in your book are not people that we associate necessarily with being super practical. I think Aristotle and Aquinas, it's interesting because obviously, as you know, in the ancient world, Aristotle had more of a reputation of being practical, but today it's philosophy. It's not kind of considered in that camp. And Aquinas,
It is a slog. It's not something that I'm taking home and I'm saying, oh, he gave me 5 easy tips to make me a better student or a better leader. And I'll add even, within Aristotle, you went with the ethics. You didn't go with the politics. You went with the headiest possible thing. And so kind of given that, what do you think, looking at some of those thinkers who are more like that, we can take out of it to view them as kind of more practically minded thinkers?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think, so the advice in the tradition kind of, you know, operates in two ways. In one side, there's the more practical, do this, don't do that. Here's how you pick personnel. Here's what a good education looks like. Things of that nature. But on the other side, what the more theoretical aspects of the tradition are focused on painting an idea, you know, a portrait of an ideal leader or the qualities that an ideal leader would have, that a leader could hold up to themselves like a mirror to examine their own conduct and character. With someone like Aquinas, you know, I think given that there were perhaps less constraints on political leaders in a, let's say, a monarchical or an imperial context. I don't want to say no constraints, because I actually think there are quite a few that we might not think of today. But because there were less constraints, at least by law, you know, part of this tradition was basically, you know, reaching out to a king or queen and saying, hey, you know, if you abandon this God stuff or this virtue stuff,
right,
you're going to suffer the torments of hell. So like, it was kind of a way of like getting their attention and saying, hey, you know, don't think you're too invincible. You know, everyone is going to die one day and meet their maker. So you better get your act together. So some of it was designed really to prick the conscience and to kind of elevate them above material concerns. And, you know, I do think Aristotle's ethics is one of those things where even though, you know, some of it might be hard to discern kind of at first glance, there is a lot of great practical advice. How do you be courageous? You know, and it actually helps to understand that most people are, you know, lean towards being too timid and too afraid. And so if you want to hit that golden mean of being courageous as a leader, you're going to need to, you know, aim your arrow a little bit past courage towards rashness. And you'll probably, you know, compensate and land right where you need to. Similarly, with temperance, most human beings are inclined to eat and drink too much.
Right.
So if you aim on the side of, you know, having a little less than you think is appropriate, you'll probably hit the mean. So I think there are aspects that are more practical, even if, you know, you don't see them at face value.
You know, when you talk about that everywhere in the world has had this tradition, one of the things I really appreciate about your book is that you did find some of the texts that aren't necessarily obvious. And so I'm wondering, from kind of the Eastern traditions, you have a text from India, a text from China, the ancient Western tradition, and then the Jewish and Christian traditions, all of which people talk a lot about the differences between these, that they're actually really fundamental differences. About a lot of different topics and how to live the best life and all these issues. In your experience, looking through these texts, did you find that they were mostly similar or that those differences manifested themselves?
Well, I think it's one of those things that at first glance, the differences are very apparent.
Right.
I think you see in Hanfei in ancient China, in Ketilia in India, and even in Xenophon, I think there is much more of a realist approach to politics. The advice in all of them is, you know, it strikes me as being much more practical in nature than some of the advice you would get in Augustine or Thomas Aquinas. And also there's, I think, more, just simply more of an emphasis on kind of the application of power.
Yep.
There's a, you know, a willingness, or even in saying, you know, like that piety is an important aspect of ruling. But at the same time, you know, there's a sense in which that's really more for public kind of perception than actual, you know, holiness. Although I will say that someone like Xenophon and Ketilia place a really strong emphasis on the restraining your kind of moral, you know, not indulging in what would be considered to be passions, you know, whether it's, you know, wine, women, et cetera. Because they think that any effective ruler needs to have those passions under control. But that's probably for different reasons than a Christian might have them under control. So in that sense, I think, you know, I actually don't see Machiavelli as much of a rupture.
Yeah.
A rupture from the medieval Christian tradition. But going back to some of these ancient texts, you know, they strike me as quite Machiavellian in a lot of their advice. But then I would say there's, you know, there's a few themes that are pretty consistent throughout. I mentioned restraint. Nearly everyone thinks, you know, you cannot be a good leader, no matter what the tradition, if you don't have moral restraint.
Mm.
That's sort of the foundation. I think most effective leaders and great leaders throughout the tradition have a strong sense of realism, even though they're not, you know, purely realist in their thinking. I think of someone like St. Thomas More, who I think really embodies kind of the virtues of a Christian realism. And then a few more areas. I think they all have a profound sense of transcendence and the common good. So in terms of transcendence, they are, you know, ordering their regime towards more permanent realities than politics. They're pointing their society towards the good or towards God himself. Secondly, the common good. There's a strong sense that, and you see this in Cicero, that a great leader is not primarily motivated by either personal gain or self-interest, nor are they going into politics on behalf of a political faction or a class interest. They really have a vision for the flourishing of the whole regime. And then lastly, I would say that beauty is a consistent theme.
Mm.
Like great leaders, they're often builders of beautiful things, and they understand the way that most people don't approach politics from reason first and foremost. You know, their imaginations are captured through beautiful things, whether that's a cathedral or a palace or a museum or a library or infrastructure connecting, you know, roads, bridges, things like that. And it's through beauty that they're able to build a legacy that endures, you know, long beyond their reign. And so I think a combination of those things are really present in all of these thinkers throughout the tradition.
That's really kind of amazing, because that is one, the beauty piece specifically, one thing I have absolutely never heard discussed anywhere for advice from the modern era for politicians.
Yeah, it's a shame that it's
not. How could it be a constant and then just totally disappear? That's crazy.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, part of it, you know, so I mean, part of the reason it probably was a constant is when you had, so, you know, in many of these contexts, there was not a legislative branch that was separated from the executive branch. And so if a king or queen, you know, has control of the purse, they're probably going to want to build monuments, you know, so they can very easily say, all right, we're going to raise taxes by X amount, and we're going to start building beautiful things, you know, in the capital and throughout the empires. So that might be one reason. I guess one aspect that's interesting, you know, in the American context is, you know, obviously we have some beautiful monuments in Washington, D.C. But so I think a lot of the activity of the statesman that you would have seen in these more historic contexts actually shifted to the realm of the entrepreneur.
Yeah, definitely.
And so you see the kind of the if you're thinking about, okay, who are the, you know, quote unquote, like great men in American history, right? You think obviously of a few of our presidents, but I think history will largely look back and say, oh, you have John D. Rockefeller or Henry Ford, and you can kind of go down the list. And what was peculiar about the sort of self-made aristocratic class 100 years ago in America is they did have this strong sense of public spiritedness. And so every city, you know, you'd go to Pittsburgh and they would want to build an opera and an art museum and a cathedral that would rival or maybe even top the one in New York or the one in Detroit or Chicago, because there was almost an aspect of honor and kind of trying to outcompete the other sort of elites in the public realm, the way that many old kind of kings or rulers would have done. And I don't know that. I mean, I'm trying to think if today, you know, a political leader says, I have a vision to beautify America. I don't know. That would be an interesting sell to Congress.
Yeah. I mean, and I think, I don't know. It doesn't seem to me that that's where very much, if any, billionaire philanthropy is directed towards these days either. But I think some of that's also just things have moved online. It's considered bigger or more impressive sometimes to do something that's not physical. I'm sort of curious, well, one, The Machiavellian strand in the non-Western selections that you chose also really struck me. I mean, there's this that amazing quote from Al-Farabi, the Muslim thinker, about how being a good politician is like being a good doctor. And who cares if they use their health to do good or bad? Your job is to heal. I was checking the chapter. I was like, is this the Machiavelli chapter that I flipped to the wrong page? But I have a question actually about the Chinese inclusion, Han Fei. Because you said when speaking about in your introduction that he breaks from the Western tradition in advising that rulers keep a low profile and only appear in public when necessary. That was kind of interesting to me that you considered that very opposite to the Western tradition. Why wouldn't that be good advice in the West?
So, and perhaps that comment is more so thinking about statesmen in the West in the last 100 years. So if I think about the statesmen that I included that are more recent, that I essentially added to this tradition to bring it up to the modern day, I focused on, the 20th century, Charles de Gaulle, Winston Churchill, and Teddy Roosevelt. And so I think there's, a couple things. I think with Teddy Roosevelt and Winston Churchill, perhaps I should make the caveat and say, I'm specifically thinking in the Anglo-American context.
Interesting.
Right. Okay. The political leaders, I think you just have to be leading out front, I mean, just think of FDR, think of JFK, think of Ronald Reagan, right? Even think of Donald Trump. Like, these are people that are very visible. And their entire lives are almost external. It's hard to even say who are these individuals interpersonal. Like, we don't know what their inner life is like. In some cases, they may not have much of an inner life at all. Charles de Gaulle is a little bit different. He was very aloof and never kind of went to the mess hall. He never really liked to be in public around other people. So he kind of much had this perhaps maybe a more Eastern view. So if you go back to Han Fei, why is it that you would want this more kind of reserved, low profile? Part of it was to cultivate an aura of mystery. Because in the ancient world, really kings were also considered to be gods, right? This idea of sacral kingship pretty much was ubiquitous in the ancient world. Were in ancient China, whether you're in Mesopotamia or whether you were in sort of, in the Americas. And so if you're having to convince the people that you are also a god or divine in some way, having that aura of mystery and not being too, you're trying to not be too, not to humanize yourself too much, or you might kind of stop buying it. But there was another reason too, and you see this in Han Fei, his advice on his ministers. And he basically says that your ministers should never know your own desires or your own policy preferences, which seems kind of crazy. Now you think, okay, you filled your cabinet with people who agree with your policy agenda. But for him, he was dealing with a more permanent bureaucratic class, and he was trying to make them more responsive. And so what he would advise is that, the ministers will essentially come and present their ideas. They'll be asked a question, they'll present their ideas, and then the king will remain impassible and not reveal his thoughts, and then they'll all leave. And then he can decide which course of action to take when he's all alone by himself, because if they know where he's leaning, the ministers will tailor their words to appeal to him and will deploy flattery and things like that. It's a lot harder to do if you don't know what your boss or your king wants from the start. So that's one example.
Yeah, I mean, it is kind of interesting because there's a mix in your book of people who were in that more bureaucratic advisory role and people who were... Actually, it's kind of interesting. I noticed the first half of the book tended to be people who were not political leaders. And then as we move to the present, you get Washington and Teddy Roosevelt and de Gaulle and people who had very serious actual political impacts on their countries and then happened to also write. Do you think some of the differences in advice come from those different kinds of positions? And do you think also that there's a reason why a lot of what we have from the ancient world are people sort of writing treatises from advisory roles, and what you chose for the modern world were very much people with practical experience?
Yeah. So in the ancient world, really the genre of the mirrors for princes served two functions, right? It was either for educators who wanted to get the job of being the tutor to the royal family. And so this was essentially a mix of, it was almost like they're putting their curriculum together and their vision of what they want to instill in the next generation of princes. So they were essentially auditioning to be a tutor, or they were auditioning to be a court minister, right? So that's pretty much the entire context for the tradition. As we move to the modern era, this is hard. This is a really good question.
Sorry, I didn't mean to.
It's a good question because, in one sense, we don't really have the one-on-one tutorial model of education anymore. I think that's to our shame, but we do have sort of a sector of elite universities that are, in theory, supposed to be playing that role. So maybe you would find most of those tutors, the aspiring tutors for princes and princesses at places like Harvard or Princeton or Stanford or Cambridge these days. Obviously, you had that with kind of the boarding schools. You know, historically, a lot of American presidents went to these old school, like boarding schools in the Northeast, like Groton or, others. And so they got some of this education instilled in them. Then if you think of political advisors, I guess you have people like Henry Kissinger, who are part of what you might describe as kind of a foreign policy bureaucracy or an expert class, and they kind of cycle in and out of administrations. And so in that sense, we still do have, and I think interestingly enough, between administrations, you have kind of two camps. You have the Republican, obviously you have two camps, the Republicans and Democrats, and you have people that kind of cycle in and out as advisors for one team or another. And so interestingly, in between administrations, what do? They land at a think tank, in DC or at a position at one of the Ivy League schools. And they normally publish a book, and the book often has something to do with like the they might be a China expert and here's their vision of China. And they spend 3 years, in between a presidential administration, really promoting all the ideas in that book and sort of selling it like, hey, whoever's the next president, you should pick me to be your national security advisor. Right. And then they'll advise the campaign. And then if their side is victorious, then they'll kind of get on board. So in that sense, I could have looked for people that had been long-term advisors for different presidents and see if someone like Kissinger or others would have any good advice. But most people, aren't as familiar with those thinkers. And so I just decided to stick with presidents.
Well, I guess looking at the ancient world, for example, I mean, one of the examples that I was kind of chewing on as I was reading it is how different would our vision of Greek statesmanship look if instead of Aristotle's politics, we had the letters of Alexander the Great or something like that, but which is a sort of very extreme example because it can be kind of hard to draw the line between what Aristotle said and what Alexander did. They seem kind of like extremes in a lot of ways. But another interesting one might be Cicero versus Augustus, because we do have, for instance, like the deeds of divine Augustus, if that had been the text, it would present a pretty different picture of politics than Cicero. But Augustus also loved Cicero, even though he essentially killed him. But
yeah, this is great. So I did not include the deeds of the quote unquote divine Augustus.
Right. Well, I can see why, but just as a thought experiment.
Right. I did actually Cicero, I did include selections from Eusebius's The Life of Constantine.
Right, right, right.
Which in many respects could be considered a Christian Augustus. He could be. I think there are definitely practical things to learn. It is one of those things where obviously Cicero was Yeah, there's a lot to explore. And whether, I mean, Cicero arguably has the most famous, On Duties could be considered to be the most famous of the Mirrors for Princes books in terms of its legacy lasted millennia. I mean, Thomas More is said to have never left the house without a copy of it in his breast pocket. It was presented to numerous kings and queens, shaped the early church fathers. But in some sense, Cicero lost, you know?
Right.
The Roman Republic was never restored. Like, that was the whole point of this book, was to revive Roman republicanism for a different age. And, you know, the legacy of Caesar Augustus was a profound one, you know? And I think, you know, if you, I guess, go back a little farther, you mentioned Alexander the Great. From what I've, you know, gathered and heard, Alexander was actually quite inspired by Cyrus the Great and by Xenophon's portrait of Cyrus.
Oh, interesting.
And for him, that was a major inspiration for conquering, you know, eastward.
Interesting. Yeah, and that is another thing that I really liked about your book is you chose a lot of selections that cited the previous selections. So you do kind of get a sense of the thread being drawn through it, which was kind of a lovely experience. I was like, aha, I have the context.
Well, I'm glad you picked up on that. It was intentional, but I hope it's intentional on the reader's side too.
Yeah. Looking a little bit at the biblical examples that you selected, I was kind of struck. I mean, if we talk about examples to emulate, examples not to emulate, Judith and Holofernes. In the introduction, you're like, well, there are really three things I could have picked. I could have done Esther, I could have done Daniel, and then I could have done Judith, who, in your words, seduces and beheads. And that's the one that you went with among the three. So why?
It's a great question. And I should add that my wife's patron saint is Judith.
Okay.
Bold choice there. what I love about Judith, you know, and for those of you who are, you know, not familiar with the story, basically, Israel is besieged by the Assyrians. She is a very beautiful, but also a very pious widow. She decides, you know, after praying on it, that she kind of deceives the Jewish leaders a little, the priests a little bit, and said, you know, she tells them part of her plan, but I don't think the fullness of it. And she slips essentially behind enemy lines. She seduces the Assyrian general, Holofernes. She gets him drunk in his tent. And she prays for the Lord's deliverance before she does this, because obviously, you know, seducing and getting a general drunk is pretty risky business. And thankfully, he drinks too much, passes out. She cuts his head off and, you know, returns, and the Jews are victorious, ultimately. The thing that I love about this is because what I'm really trying to do is to move politics, especially for conservatives, out of the realm of theory and into the realm of action.
Yeah.
And I think there's a temptation to say, you know, okay, everything in Machiavelli, you know, there are a lot of evil pieces of advice in Machiavelli, but there's a temptation to say sort of Machiavellian approach is all evil. And therefore all we need to do is have a good or moral person in political office, and therefore all the right policy and all the right management and administration will follow. And I really just don't think that's true. You know, I think it's, you obviously, being good might be a prerequisite for being a great ruler, but it's not sufficient. And so I'm trying to look at examples of people who did really courageous things, even things that might have seemed, you know, incredibly daring and even risky, and were willing to be both kind of faithful in their own religious traditions and to their moral compass, but really put themselves out there. And I think Judith really did that in an extreme way, but one in which she was ultimately victorious, right? And there's a little bit of Machiavelli in Judith, if I can say so without getting in too much trouble, which is she's revered, right? At least in the Orthodox Church, probably in the Catholic Church, as being a saint, right? And has had this whole book written about her because she was successful, right? If she had failed, right? If Holofernes had taken advantage of her and killed her, right? People would say, well, that's a tale of like, that she was just being really rash and she got herself killed. And who knows, maybe she's not even considered she wouldn't be considered to be a saint for sure. And so Yeah, but because her means were proved right, because she was victorious, we look back at it positively. And so I just think, to me, it's, you know, it's the same kind of, you know, it's like Thomas More in the sense of she is someone who's, you know, in the arena, kind of really laying it all out there and did something heroic that I think needs to be worth elevating.
Yeah, I'm just going to play devil's advocate a little bit here, because you acknowledge pretty upfront, you say there's some examples in this book worthy of imitation, some that are evil. Why wouldn't it be dangerous to give students a book that says, okay, some of this is really good advice, some of this is evil, I'm not going to tell you which is which, have at it.
Great question. Well, so I think the first thing is that if you're in any position of leadership, I mean, people are going to employ all of the tactics against you that Machiavelli advises, or that Ahan Fei advises, or that any of these kind of, you know, quote unquote bad people are advising. And so I think you're just going to go into it very naive if you're not aware of the methods and tactics that can be used against you. And I think it's the case, and I think this is sadly the case because we're human beings and we're fallen and sinful. But it is 100% true that whether you're talking about the church and church governance, or whether you're talking about the conservative movement, or whether you're talking about Republican politics, like the cause can be as noble as possible. But the reality is that human beings are fallen, and every single thing that you know, people will do bad things and come after you in every way possible, even if you're in a worthy context or setting. And I think it's just far better for people to be aware of what could be used against you instead of being ignorant of it and learn their lesson a hard way.
Yeah, and I think it begs, I guess I'll ask the question from the other side. Does being a good, faithful person make you a better leader? And it's funny that this comes up, because actually I had a very spirited debate about this with some of the postdocs at the Madison program a few weeks ago. It was sort of like Machiavelli on one side, Augustine on the other. And I mean, I'm not a PhD, so I was kind of doing my best, but I do not have that. I don't have the Augustine citations memorized. But I mean, I guess there's sort of a biblical perspective, which is, okay, Jesus says, you know, it's easier for a camel to fit through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to go to heaven. You could argue that he's sort of promising this religion's not going to make you better at your job. It will probably make you worse. And then there's kind of the flip side, which is more, yeah, like a lot of the Western theologians like Aquinas and Augustine that you bring in. So where, I guess, draw out those debate lines for me? Does your book have a stance?
So specifically on whether or not being good is a requirement or makes you actually equips you to be a better leader.
Yeah.
So in one sense, it's absolutely true. And in the sense of you cannot be, I think it's the case that you can't be a good leader unless you, or even a great leader, unless you're willing to make your own, you know, personal interest. It's not that there's times when your personal interest doesn't align with the common good, but I think you have to be consciously subjecting your personal interest in the interest of your own particular faction, right, or class, to the common good. And someone can only do that if they have, you know, a clear sense of the moral ends that they're pursuing in politics. Similarly, with the restraint piece of advice, you know, this is something, again, it's in Machiavelli, it's in Catilia, it's in Aristotle, you know, it's in Thomas Aquinas. Like, there is no realm in which you can be a good political leader without having moral restraint. In a way that I think is actually true, you know, if you just translate that to sports or to brain surgery, right? Like, to be a professional athlete requires disciplining your body in a, you know, very strong ways. Similarly, being a great brain surgeon requires decades of study and apprenticeship, whatever. So in one sense, yeah, the moral qualities are absolutely necessary for being a good leader. But I would say that there are moral scruples that I would say, if you're, it depends what you mean by good. You know,
right.
I think lots
right,
of people,
right.
I think there are ways that, so, I mean, you could give historic examples like Justinian. He was dealing with riots, you know, in ancient Byzantium. And the rioters were kind of incited by one of the senatorial factions. They burned down the Hagia Sophia. They were coming for the palace. And even some of the soldiers that were part of the palace guard were likely on the side of the rioters. And so what do you do in a situation like that when the whole stability of the whole city and the empire is hanging in the balance? Justinian wanted to flee to the countryside or to leave the country for a period of time, go into exile and then come back and reestablish control. His wife, Theodora, said, no, it's better to die than to give up the royal purple. Like, we need to fight. And so he took her advice. He led 30,000 people into the Hippodrome and he had them all slaughtered, right? And he put down the riots by killing 30,000 people. And then he rebuilt the Hagia Sophia and restored order. And that was the end of it, right? Even in a situation like that, he killed 30,000 people, right?
Right.
If you're thinking about the fate of your soul, that's a lot of blood that's on your hands, you know? And so you could, and obviously you can give a million different hypothetical scenarios. Like if it were one, I feel like if you were to ask people today, most people would be uncomfortable with an action like that.
Right.
But if you were to say, okay, it's one guy and he's a terrorist and he has a bunch of bombs rigged up all over Washington, D.C., do you lure him onto the Washington, on the mall in Washington and take him out with a sniper? I think most people would say, well, of course, he's a terrorist and he has all these. So like there's a weird way in which the moral calculus changes. I think ultimately with just war theory, you want kind of whatever, if you're the state, right, the response, the violent response needs to be in proportion to the threat. And so the proportionality, I think, is a big and part of that. So all I'm saying by giving, we could do these kind of moral dilemmas all day long. I think many leaders are not super holy personally, right?
Yeah.
And I think it's because in these situations, they just act very decisively to do what needs to be done to kind of just preserve the regime or preserve the state. And then they kind of hope that on the back end that they can kind of work things out with God, right? Or that they have a bishop or whoever, someone who's sympathetic, and they can kind of like deal with some of the moral questions later. And so I think it's which makes it even hard. It's hard to be a ruler, and many of the great kind of political leaders, even American presidents, you know, how many of them are in heaven? You know, obviously only God knows, but not many of them seem to really have like serious devout holiness to them. And I think that's just because of the profession often demands that people make a lot of these decisions that are in very gray moral territory. And unless you're very sensitive to the health of your soul, you can get corroded by making those choices.
I'm sorry, because I know that was a really hard question, and I'm going to ask another one that's a little bit edgy. But okay. So now they're kind of in a couple of strong women that have come up over the course of our conversation. Judith, who I think, I mean, for instance, in my AP art history class in high school, is like feminist icon. Judith cut off the man's head, did the whole thing. And Justinian and Theodora, another great example. In your book, you bring up Christine de Pizan, which is, I think, interesting because you are conservative and, you know, tossing in a female voice is not something that all conservatives would necessarily do. Do you think that there is a link between statesmanship and masculinity?
So in one sense, there's absolutely a link. And I think that's, that's obvious in light of the fact that kind of most of the, I say most, not all, because I featured a number of female statesmen or advisors, but I think most of the great statesmen from the past, you know, have, if you go back to kind of the education of Cyrus in ancient Persia, right, he has a very martial education.
Yeah.
Like it is militaristic. And it's just something that, that most women, not all, but most women probably wouldn't have done it in the ancient world. Right. And maybe in the modern world, they probably wouldn't prefer sort of a martial education where for 10 years, you're sleeping outside in the public square guarding monuments. And when you're not guarding the monuments, you're out with the king hunting for days on end, and you're basically starving and sleeping and out in the elements, right? So I think historically, a lot of these leaders have been military conquerors in some way, shape, or form, which generally means that they're going to be men, right? And they're going to be explaining, sort of embodying, I think, those kind of the either traditional male virtues or just kind of the general idea of like the king is a father to his country, or Washington is the father of America. And so, yeah, so I think there's a way in which they embody kind of hopefully the ideal aspects of fatherhood. However, there's a couple interesting things when you think of women in political leadership. The one is that I find it quite interesting that despite America being founded on the idea of political equality, that we haven't had a female president in our history, yet the ancient world, which was far more hierarchic and far more patriarchal, had, you know, far more female leaders than our own modern context based on equality. I don't actually know the answer to that puzzle, but that's something that kind of has struck me as interesting.
Is that true? That's surprising. Because I can't think of that many. I mean, the ancient history is so long, sure. And American history is so short in comparison.
Well,
it doesn't seem like there have been that many.
Maybe it is unfair to do that because you're comparing all of, you know, if you were to give us another thousand years, you know, we probably would have some female presidents. But you know, I guess the point is when we're thinking of great, you know, female statesmen, we're mostly thinking of certainly a more of a monarchical context, right? Queen Elizabeth, you know, the first and the second, Queen Victoria, Catherine the Great, Theodora, Judith, Esther, etc. The second thing I would say is that there's an interesting quality that I have found in female political leadership, which is cunning. So it strikes me, and this is true. I don't know if any of your listeners would have watched Game of Thrones, or if that kind of brings shame on me to mention that I'm a fan of Game of Thrones. But you do see like the female characters in Game of Thrones, like how they survive, how they make it, how they exert their influence is by being cunning, you know, and hopefully using that kind of craftiness for the proper end. So there's even kind of almost an element of deception. You know, this is certainly the case with Judith. That was the case with Esther. You see this in some of the other kind of great female leaders. And I think that is often because they're often not conquerors who are leading armies, right? They have to use other skills to make their influence have an impact. And so they're very adept. They're very crafty in how they kind of deploy their means to achieve their ends. Maybe, I don't know, maybe there's something about the Machiavellian tradition is really one for the female political influencers and leaders.
That's very interesting. So kind of to start to close this out here, as we're headed towards time, you sort of said at the beginning of this conversation, you know, we're all a prince in our way, and you head ISI, which is a student-based organization, really. So most students are not president of the United States. Technically, none of them are, actually. But there are a lot of kind of applications for leadership in smaller contexts that I think students are pretty regularly confronted with. So if you kind of had to summarize, you know, based on this book, for people in that demographic, for people who are students, what are some of the biggest takeaways about how to take these leaders and advisors from the distant past and totally different societies and say, when I'm doing something, when I'm leading a club, when I'm trying to be a leader in the classroom, when I'm trying to start a career in which I'm going to have some kind of leadership role, what are the takeaways?
Sure. That's a great question. And I actually just got back from an ISI student seminar in Dallas, where we spent 3 days reading through this book with students and trying to make it a little bit more concrete for them.
So then I guess I'll ask, what did they like? That's maybe the better question.
No, that's a good question. They liked it. You know, they really liked Xenophon and Cyrus. That was like, it kept coming back to Xenophon. They liked Charles de Gaulle as well. So a few pieces of practical advice. Cicero is actually great for practical advice. So one of Cicero's points is that we must work harder at the things that we are better suited at and better suited for. So this is basically the idea, which I think is a little counterintuitive, that you should actually spend more time focusing on your strengths than on your weaknesses. So if you have an extra hour a day, you know, devote that to doing something that you're excellent at instead of trying to improve in an area that you're not as well suited for. Because when you invest your time in your strengths, you're going to see exponential growth. But when you invest time trying to improve weaknesses, you're going to see only marginal growth. And so, you know, that's probably even decent advice for like beating, you know, I don't know, a sin or a vice in your life, right? Instead of just trying with all of your will to like resist the vice, it's probably better advice to focus on some aspect of piety that you're better at and kind of really lean into that. And by doing so, you may not even find yourself being drawn to that vice. And so I think that's just, if you're in terms of picking a major, in terms of starting out in your career, you might get a job where you have to do a lot of things and some of them you're not going to be good at. But I think the quicker that you can find your own niche, right, and delegate the things you're not good at to other people, the faster you're going to kind of rise at your institution. Another piece of advice, and it's again, it's a kind of a cliche, but Cicero says that the shortcut to greatness is to start acting like the person that you want to become. So it's really almost a fake it till you make it sort of approach, wherein, you know, if you start pretending to be the type of person you want to be, pretty soon, actually, you'll convince other people that you are that person. And then as the other people start to affirm and see that in yourself, you yourself will eventually be persuaded. So there's an element of self kind of trickery. Just start acting like the person you want to be. And then I think another one, again, right out of Cicero, is that you essentially rise to the level of those that you associate with. So if you want to become, you know, seen as being famous and wise in public life, you should spend your time with people that are genuinely virtuous, right? And all of a sudden people will look at you from the outside and they will start to associate you with the people that you spend your time with. Most people, you know, I think the world really, it works on relationships. Relationships are the capital that matters even more than money, right? Even more than your pedigree. And if you have the right people that are going to bat for you, every door will be open that you can imagine, you know? And if you don't have people in your corner, if you're trying to go it alone, or if you have the wrong people in your corner, you're not going to get anywhere. And so it strikes me that the people who are most connected are the ones that most get ahead. I think there's a way that you can do all of these things without, still within the context of sort of a, you know, ambition that's kind of operating within a Christian or otherwise religious context.
Well, Johnny, this has been amazing. I promise I did read the book, but I still learned so much listening to you. You're an absolute fount of wisdom. So the book will be linked in the show notes for the listeners. Please do check it out.
Thank you so much, Annika. That was a lot of fun. And good questions, too. I really, those are some tough ones, but I appreciate it.
Well, there you have it, Madisonians, Johnny Burtka IV on his new edited collection, Gateway to Statesmanship. It's linked in the show notes. You should absolutely go check it out. As always, if you enjoyed this episode, please do leave us a rating or review. We really, really appreciate it. You can also find out more about us at the Madison Program and what we do here on Princeton's campus at jmp.princeton.edu. There, you can find all of our previous podcasts, also the recordings of all of our previous lectures here at Princeton and our schedule of upcoming events, and you can sign up for our mailing list. You can also find us on social media, on Twitter at Madison Program, as well as on Instagram and Facebook. As always, thank you so much for tuning in, and I can't wait to see you next week here on Madison's Notes.